Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I'm coming to you live from Macquarie University. I am here with Sean Crossan. He is the leader of the Sport and Exercise Research Group at NUI Galloway. He is the co-director of the MA in Sports Journalism and Communication, and he is working at the Houston School of Film and Digital Media. Thank you very much for joining us today, Sean.
Thank you, Keith. Delighted to speak with you.
Sean, we're here today to talk about your book, Gaelic Games on Film, From Silent Films to Hollywood Hurling, Horror, and the Emergence of Irish Cinema, which is out from Cork University Press. It's just a fascinating book. I really loved reading it, and I want to encourage all of our listeners to go pick up a copy right away. Can you tell us how you developed this project?
So yeah, it's a long story. I touch on this briefly in my initial acknowledgements, but the book is about it was over 12 years in the writing, and perhaps even longer than that if you go back to my initial interest and engagement with Gaelic Games. I suppose the background, and to give some context for that, in Ireland, perhaps unusually and not entirely uniquely, but it's certainly one of the distinctive features of Irish popular culture, is that the engagement with sport in Ireland, the most popular sports are the amateur indigenous sports, Gaelic football and hurling, or Gaelic games, as we call them collectively. And I grew up in a context in Ireland where Gaelic games were a key part of the local community, and of what in many ways defined the community, and that, if anything, has increased with the increasing secularization of Ireland, a country that for many people, I think, and many of your listeners perhaps, will be associated with historically with Catholicism, the Catholic Church, as a powerful force in Irish society. But as that force has declined, Gaelic games and indigenous sport has grown in importance as a key kind of social fulcrum for communities, particularly in rural Ireland. And I grew up in rural Ireland, and grew up in a context where Gaelic games was a key component within that society. And latterly, as an academic, I developed a specialism within film studies here at NUI Galway. And in 2006, there was an academic conference here in NUI Galway. It was the Irish Sports History Association, and it was hosted by a colleague of mine at that time in NUI Galway, who asked me at the time, is there much Gaelic games on film? And it hadn't been something I had given a great deal of consideration to at that time, but it began a journey that 13 years later, a fascinating journey really for me, to find that there is an extraordinary history of the depiction of Gaelic games on Ireland that goes right back to the very earliest days of the 20th century, and that it provides, again, a very unique and insight into the sports as they developed through the 20th century and into the 21st century, but also not just in terms of the insight it gives you into how the sports have developed. And of course, the films of the early 20th century into the mid-20th century are the only moving image record we have prior, of course, to television or the advent of other digital media forms in the more recent past. And in that respect, there is a crucial historical record of the evolution of these sports. But they also are interesting insofar as they give us an insight into the differing ways in which sport features in popular culture, both from the point of view of how these sports functioned within an international context, particularly within American cinema. And I go into some detail in that in the book and what I call Hollywood hurling chapter, how it functioned within kind of mainstream international film. And also, and latterly, and how it functioned within indigenous Irish cinema and became a key part of a defining period in the emergence of a distinctive film culture within Ireland in the latter half of the 20th century.
I was, while reading, just impressed with the diversity of avenues in which you kind of pursue these questions of Gaelic games and film. I mean, looking, what I was most interested in before I picked up the book was this question of kind of the way in which sport helped shape Irish identity and politics. That's what I was prepared for the whole book to be about. But in fact, you touch on very much on the way in which sport helped shape this development of this film culture, as you're mentioning, but also shaped the development of film itself, even in your early chapters, and so much of our cinema might be shaped by sport. In my reading, and you can tell me if this was wrong, Sean, you have 9 chapters, but I read it in 4 blocks. You have kind of your early block on early cinema in the newsreel era. Then you have this kind of international view with the Hollywood hurling and your look at Rooney, and then the growth of a kind of Irish film, what you might call an Irish film industry in the post-war period, and then finally a kind of more contemporary look at Irish film and its engagement with these sports. So I want to go chronologically. I hope that works with you. So I was hoping we could start a little bit with this era of early cinema and where are we first seeing Gaelic sport in film, and how does that help influence kind of the film as a technology even?
Well, yeah, so the beginnings, as I talk about in the book, go right back to what were at the time called early actuality films. This was before even the newsreel became established in towards the end of the first decade of the 20th century. But right back at the very beginning, in a way, like we have, of course, we go back to the Lumiere brothers in France and what they were pioneering at that time. And you have contemporaneously in the US with what Thomas Edison and his collaborators were developing. But in those very, very early days of film was a need of a subject in a way, because it was extraordinarily new and experimental. And even people that we now associate as being kind of extraordinary key figures in the popularization of film, like, for example, Charlie Chaplin himself at one point remarked that, oh, it's just a fad. He wasn't convinced that it would survive. And of course, we now know it went on to become this huge, huge international popular cultural form that, you know, has influenced a range of subsequent forms. But in those very early days, so film, this new experimental, what it was, the cinematograph in France, or what became movies in the US, it needed a subject, and sport was already a popular subject. It was already had a captive audience, and so far you had sport, and interestingly, of course, the two of them in so far as that the codification or the whole setting down of rules around sport emerged just before film came along. So the whole modernization period, sport provided the early filmmakers with a subject that in its both in its popularity and its engagement of a wide, diverse audience, and also in the way in which sport was the codification of sport. So it gave it a limited canvas in a time when cameras weren't that mobile, quite rudimentary. You could set up a camera and you could film like a dramatic activity, and sport provided that. So whether it was in the US, where sport was a key component of early cinema, early Edison film, or in for the Lumiere brothers in France, where similarly many of their early films focused on sport. And in Ireland, eventually, when early filmmakers began to film in Ireland and to develop film production companies began to emerge, Indigenous sports from very early on began to be filmed. Now, unfortunately, the first decade, we don't have any surviving films, but we have records and in terms of newspaper reports of the screenings of early of early films of hurling and of Gaelic games, and of some indication there of the responses that they were getting in terms of, I mean, one can imagine at the time film was a very new form, and then you combine that with an increasingly popular form of Indigenous cultural practice that they had an important role in both in mutually popularizing this new form and the growing popularization of Indigenous sport in Ireland. But as we get into the 1910s, fortunately, we do have a few films that survive from the 1910s. There's an early 1914 actuality film of the All-Ireland replay of that year in Gaelic football between Wexford, County Wexford and County Kerry, and that survives. 1 minute 49 seconds survive of it, but that in itself is fascinating, giving us a sense of the changing rules and the changing patterns within the sport of that period. And 4 years later, in a fiction film, again by another early Irish Indigenous production company called the Film Company of Ireland, in their first kind of major feature film, a five-reel film called Knock na Gow, we have a one-minute sequence featuring hurling, which is the earliest episode on film we have of that sport. And in each of those, we get these really kind of quite extraordinary insights into the sports as they were being perceived and engaged in at that time, and indeed in an earlier period, because Knock na Gow, the film, was based on a novel that was set in the mid-19th century. So these were filmmakers looking back to the sport even before it was codified. And the in both instances, in throughout this period, sport was an important part of the providing, again, a popular subject for emerging film companies that could help them to bring this new art form, this new technology to audiences across Ireland, much as it was doing across the world, whether it was in the United States, in France, in Britain, or in other parts of the world.
And that was a big question, at least in the second chapter of your book, in some ways, on the newsreel era, which is who gets to produce these images of Irish sport and to what end? So I wondered if you can tell us a little bit about sport in this newsreel era. Who was filming Irish sport, to what end, and maybe a little bit about the GAA and their response, and maybe tell our listeners a little bit who the GAA is, because they're such an important organization within your study.
Absolutely, yeah. I might start at the end of your question, if you don't mind, and start a little bit about who the GAA are, because of course I'm living in a context where I don't always appreciate that for international listeners and audiences, that they may not and probably aren't aware of what the GAA or what those letters stand for, the Gaelic Athletic Association, are. And they are an extraordinarily important institution in Ireland. They were founded as an association in 1884, founded for the preservation and the promotion of Indigenous sport, and they were founded in a very challenging period. Of course, this was not that long after the Irish famine. It was a period when, of course, Ireland was still very much part of the United Kingdom, as in what is now the Republic of Ireland. It was a period of great poverty and emigration from Ireland. But it was also a period when groups in Ireland were attempting to bring the culture back, to bring the society back, and to grow a sense of a distinct culture and a distinct political kind of entity in Ireland. So you had a rising tide of nationalism, both political nationalism and cultural nationalism. And within that period, the 1880s, 1890s, sport was one of the most important aspects of that growing movement, which would eventually lead to a rebellion in 1916, and eventually a war of independence, and eventually the setting up of what would become the Republic of Ireland in 1922, the Free State at that time, and Republic of Ireland from 1949. But in the period we're talking about, the foundation of the GAA, sport became a very, very important and perhaps the most important aspect of popular nationalism. It was something that, as it was described by historians, that took off like a prairie fire across Ireland in a period of great difficulty, great challenges. Gaelic games in particular provided, it was about the distinctiveness of what the sports were, as well as, of course, the enjoyment that they provided to people who either participated in it or went to watch the games. But they allowed in a context where for most Irish people, unlike most other European countries, to a large extent, one of the most distinguishing aspects of your identity is your language. And the Irish language for most people was no longer their main, so as it is today. The language went into decline with the famine in the 1840s, and also for various other reasons to do it, oppression under colonialism, but that we don't have time to get into now. But just to say that sport became very, very important as a distinctive defining element of what it was to be Irish in the context of a rising tide of Irish nationalism. And this would feed into through the late 19th and into the 20th century, and indeed continues to be an important part of that process to today. So the GAA has been extraordinarily successful as it grew. Now it in Ireland today, it has grown throughout the 20th century. And we have an extraordinary stadium, one of the largest stadiums in Europe, Croke Park, which has a capacity of 85,000. It attracts capacity crowds for the major competition, which are the All-Ireland Finals in hurling and in Gaelic football. It is the most popular sports across the island of Ireland. That's the other thing, including within the north of Ireland, particularly among the nationalist community in the north of Ireland. And these sports continue to have as a key part of them is that they're amateur sports, but played at a very, very high level, but nonetheless by amateurs. And they've had an international imprint among the Irish diaspora, including in Australia and the US. There are over some 3,000 clubs now between Ireland and internationally that are engaged in Gaelic games. Just one other thing I'll say about the GAA, and then I'll come to the film element, is that one of the kind of critical decisions that Gaelic Athletic Association made from the very beginning was that it would build the core entity for Gaelic games from the beginning was the parish, the local kind of parish, the local community, and then the local county. So there's kind of two levels, if you like. Well, there's a variety of levels, but for most clubs, for most people engaging with Gaelic games, they're engaged by their local club at their parish level and then by their county. And those connections became critical to how people's own sense of identity, sense of place became bound up. And sport, more than any Gaelic game, more than any other force perhaps in Ireland, has affirmed and popularizes people's own sense of identity as bound up with either a distinctive place and distinctive county in Ireland. And that has continued to be sustained right up until today. Now, when we get into the 1920s and onwards, in terms of how film engaged with Gaelic games, there was a period of hope that I've already referred to in terms of an indigenous film culture in the 1910s. You had a number of companies coming into existence for whom Gaelic Games was part of the films that they produced, including the Irish Animated Picture Company, the early Actuality Company that produced the surviving footage of the 1914 All-Ireland replay in football, and the Film Company of Ireland that was up in 1916 and produced Knocknagow. Unfortunately, both of these companies didn't survive the kind of revolutionary period that is the 1910s for a variety of reasons. And in the immediate aftermath of independence in 1922 for the Republic of Ireland, indeed similar things applied in the north of Ireland for different reasons, the government were not very supportive of an indigenous film culture. In fact, film for what was a very, in the south, Catholic, and for similar reasons, the Protestant church also had a, in the north of Ireland, had a kind of a lot of suspicion around film as a form, as a decadent foreign form that might impede the attempts to promote a kind of a strong Catholic identity in Ireland. So, in fact, one of the first pieces of legislation that the new parliament in the south of Ireland, the Dáil Éireann, as it's called, passed was the Censorship of Films Act, which was a very, very restrictive act, and an act that was very much informed by Catholic concerns and Catholic dogma. So for these reasons, there was very little indigenous film culture developed or an infrastructure for film to develop as an indigenous culture in Ireland in the 1920s and into the 1930s. What film work was done by international companies outside of Ireland. Particularly when we talk about newsreels, British film companies like British Pathé, like British Gaumont, and British Movietone, to name three of the most prominent. These companies were, again, as their names would suggest, primarily focused at a British market for their newsreels, but they did produce some Irish items and quite more, I think, than most Irish people would expect, or given that they were primarily British companies. But they did produce quite a number of newsreel episodes about Gaelic games, both Gaelic football and hurling. Partly these were produced because they were trying to get contracts signed with Irish exhibitors, Irish cinemas, and as part of the deals, to sweeten the deal, so to speak, they'd say, well, we'll film a Gaelic Games episode, and we'll include that in a package that would have been mostly made up of material aimed at a British audience, some of which was quite controversial in the Irish context when it focused on the British royal family, for example. So as a result of this, it meant that the depiction of Gaelic Games for those years, particularly from the 1920s through to the 1940s, was being driven or being produced by external British companies. And while those images today remain really important as the only moving image record we have of the sports in those periods, they also reveal a peculiar eye on Ireland and often a limited understanding, for example, of the sports concerned, if there was any understanding among those who were commenting on the images. They may, for example, in some episodes refer to teams incorrect by the incorrect name, or they may refer to what are counties as clubs, or they may use terminology associated with association football to apply to Gaelic football, like, for example, for the throw-in or whatever, terms that aren't appropriate to Gaelic football. So in that way, they do provide, on one level, an important record in terms of the sports, but on another level, they also reveal the kind of disjunctures that can come about, and the peculiarities that can come about when these sports are being depicted from primarily an external perspective. The other thing that occasionally occurs, particularly in British Movietone newsreels, is that they can use Gaelic Games partly to affirm kind of certain stereotypes about the Irish. For example, that the Irish are somehow more inclined towards violence, or that they're more kind of backward, or and particularly this is evident at points of political tension between Ireland and Britain. This was particularly the case in the 1930s when there was an economic war between Ireland and Britain. And you find that British Movietone newsreels, which were owned by Lord Rothermere, who also owned the Daily Mail, who was a supporter of Oswald Mosley's fascists and was of that inclination himself, and had a very, I suppose, negative view of Éamon de Valera, who was the political leader in Ireland at that time, the then Prime Minister of Ireland in the 1930s. And some of this is evident in how the newsreels depict Irish sport in that period and into the 1940s.
Yeah, I was fascinated a little bit at the end of that chapter when you were just pulling apart some of the different sympathies of the different companies, British Pâté, Gaumont, especially Movietone, showing that even within the British movie producers, there's not one way of looking at the Gaelic Games. Hollywood was also interested at the time, and I think it's fair to say, looking at some of these same stereotypes about the Irish. So what kind of depictions of Gaelic Games are we seeing in this era of Hollywood hurling?
Yeah, I mean, that was, for me, one of the most fascinating discoveries was, I suppose, first of all, discovering that there were films, Hollywood films, about hurling. And then to kind of watch the films, and just to give you a bit of that, I don't know if I probably touch upon it in the book, but when I was... what happened there is I was doing some research in the US in a small library archive in Madison, Wisconsin, and I found they had in their basement, they had, what had happened was the American Film Institute had distributed surviving film material across various small archives in the US to kind of share out the material. And this archive, the historical archive in Madison, Wisconsin, they had received a range of material, but it had been catalogued. So it was in a kind of sealed box in their basement. So we went down there and opened it up. And we found several fascinating Hollywood productions, short films from the 1930s about hurling. There was several episodes of a very popular comedy sports sequence series called, well, one called Sports Lance, the other called Sports Trills, which was produced by the Vitaphone Corporation for Warner Bros. In the early 1930s, but produced as and narrated by one of the key kind of figures in sports commentary in that period, Ted Husing. And Ted Husing was extraordinarily influential figure for sports commentary in the US in a formative period of radio commentary and subsequently television commentary on sport. And these were very, very popular, I suppose, sports items that were shown in cinema schedules in this period. And in it, there's two that feature hurling. And what was interesting to me, I suppose not entirely surprising, was that they're using hurling essentially to affirm a particular stereotype about the Irish. Well, on one hand, it's about bringing out the comic potentiality of these sports. On the other hand, it's about, you know, hurling, looking at the sport and saying, you couldn't, if you were to invent in a sport for the Irish that could potentially affirm the stereotype, hurling is the one that would seem to do it, because it has that potential on first encounter for violence and for injury and so on, because it has, you know, people whacking small balls with sticks and injuries that may occur. Now, of course, this is far from the reality for most at the elite level. For most people engaged in hurling, there's no more potential for injury than most other contact sports. But it did seem to have a kind of peculiarity about it and a potential that was responded to cinematically by Hollywood studios in this period. Particularly, there's the Ted Husing films in the early 1930s. There's an MGM film called simply Hurling, a short film from 1926, which is an extraordinary depiction of hurling and its focus on the violence of the sport and the way in which the sport is even described in terms of the publicity material around it at the time. And I refer to some of this in the book, where hurling is described as a scientific form of mass murder, for example. And this kind of is integrated into the diegesis of the film itself. And then I also refer to a later film in the 1950s, which was, there was one short about hurling that Paramount Studios produced called Three Kisses, which was Oscar nominated in that year for the best live action short. And that also is a fascinating depiction in terms of how it was a work produced by a Hollywood studio, but one that was also an attempt by both the Gaelic Athletic Association and the Irish Tourist Board, Board Fáilte, who worked together with this company to try and address some of the kind of stereotypical depictions of earlier depictions, not entirely successfully, but in its time, it still is a fascinating record of the sport and of the tensions around its depiction between that international perspective and the indigenous concerns about depicting sport more positively, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, we've focused mostly a little bit on kind of reportage of sport, but there are also dramatic depictions of these sports coming out of the United States and in the UK at this time too, aren't there? Can we talk a little bit about some of these kind of depictions of hurling within dramas?
Absolutely. So one of the things, and we're talking a lot about hurling, and I should probably just say a little bit insofar as in Ireland and in terms of Gaelic games in Ireland, the most popular Gaelic game by far is Gaelic football. It's played much more widely across the entire island, and it generally attracts larger crowds, with the exception of the All-Ireland final, the final stages of the main competitions, which are All-Ireland, what we call the All-Ireland series in both Gaelic football and hurling. They are the Super Bowls, if you like, from the American context, if I could make a comparison with that. But in the Irish context, they are the Super Bowls of Gaelic games. But Gaelic football is generally much, much more popular. But one of the interesting findings for me was when I looked at films, and particularly international productions, that hurling is by far the most popular sport that's depicted. And in a way, this connects with what I was referring to already, that it is perhaps the more distinctive sport. It also has those kind of the potential to connect with the stereotype about the violent Irish or the kind of slightly irrational or peculiar Irish stereotype. It also has a kind of a connection, a mythical connection. So hurling has an ancient pedigree. There are descriptions of the sport or a sport like hurling going back thousands of years in Gaelic manuscripts and mythology, figures like Cuchulainn or Setanta in Irish mythology. So it has that kind of historical and mythological resonance, which Gaelic football does not. And some of that we find feeding into film as well and into film drama. And in terms of, I mentioned the Hollywood shorts, but I suppose a key figure for the representation of Ireland from American cinema is the Irish-American director John Ford. Of course, an extraordinarily important figure in the classical Hollywood period, particularly for the Western. But he also had, both of his parents came from the West of Ireland. His films are often informed by Irish culture and Irish concerns. Particularly is that function in the American context. But with regard to Gaelic games, they also feature occasionally in his work. And this goes right from the biggest commercially successful film produced was a film called The Quiet Man from 1952, which was set in Ireland and is a returning immigrant narrative about an Irish-American coming back and trying to reintegrate into a community in the West of Ireland. But within that, there is a reference to hurling at one point, but using it again in a context where hurling is referred to prefaces a very lengthy fight sequence at the end of the film. And there is the suggestion, again, that hurling is connected with or juxtaposed with violence. And in each of his other subsequent films, including The Rising of the Moon from 1958 and Young Cassidy from 65, you have sequences that either have hurling players depicted coming back battered and bruised on stretchers after a game, or hurling players engaged in fisticuffs with members of the Royal Irish Constabulary in Young Cassidy. But one of the things I talk about in the book, and it's easy to look at these, as people did at the time, particularly The Rising of the Moon, around which there was a lot of controversy at the time, and a delegation from the Gaelic Athletic Association that went to the set to complain about the way in which Gaelic games were being depicted. But at the same time, one of the other things that I touch upon in the book is how these, how Ford's films are constantly kind of, they're foregrounding the stereotype, but they're simultaneously undermining it or questioning it or poking fun at it or interrogating it in some way. And this is an important part of what Ford was engaged in, indeed what other Irish-American directors were engaged in at this period, which was taking kind of familiar stereotypes about the Irish and transforming them from what were previously negative, threatening stereotypes into something that was much more non-threatening or amusing or entertaining. And it's a larger process that saw Irish America move from the margins of American society to the very center of American society. By the end of the 1950s and 1961, you have the election of Irish American President John F. Kennedy. And part of the process that enabled that to happen was how Irish America itself transformed through things like using Gaelic games, but transforming them, using them in a kind of a comic context, transforming the kind of concerns of the threat that was perceived around Irishness or Irish stereotypes into more acceptable and positive forms. And film was certainly part of that process. The other film I talk about, and there are several others we may come to if we have time, is the British film Rooney, which came out in that period in the 1950s. And this is a feature-length film based on a Katrin Cookson novel that was had nothing to do with sport, but it was transformed entirely and moved to Ireland. About the only thing that was kept from the original story, which was set in South Shields in the northeast of England, was the binman central protagonist. But in the film, he's transformed into a Dublin binman whose real talents lie on the hurling field as a hurler with the local team. And in that, you can see some of the stereotypes coming through from both the quiet man, but also those British stereotypes around violence and sport, but being worked through a kind of a comic idiom, if you like. So using comedy as a way to draw on the stereotypes, but also in a way, I guess, to deactivate the kind of threat that may have been associated with those stereotypes previously.
So in the latter half of the 20th century, Irish filmmakers and Irish film organizations start to, I guess, wrest control of the depictions of Gaelic games away from international filmmakers and use them in particular ways. So I wonder, you cover this in chapters 5 and 6 in your book, and you're looking at the National Film Institute of Ireland and Gail Lynn. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. I apologize.
No, you're not. Not this. That's perfectly pronounced.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of these Irish film institutions and how they were using filmic depictions of sport, pardon me, as a way to you know, shape Irish identity in this troubled period in the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that in the immediate aftermath of independence, so early 1920s, that the church and state were very suspicious of film as a form, and the only state policy really towards film for the first couple of decades was censorship and controlling film, and by no, in no way trying to encourage an indigenous film culture. Things changed from about 1936 on, and the reason, again, it was the church that kind of led the change, given the power it held in Ireland at the period in the time, in that the then Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical called Vigilante Cura, which for the first time identified film as actually having a beneficial and positive role, potentially, as an educational resource. And this inspired members of the clergy in Ireland to become more involved in film practice. And it eventually led, in 1945, to the setting up of the National Film Institute of Ireland under the auspices of the Archbishop of Dublin, John Charles McQuaid, and made up of a board of, I think there was five priests and some then lay in film enthusiasts on that board. Now, they began initially, but I should say importantly, one of the people on that board was the Ard Rooney, or an English General Secretary of the Gaelic Athletic Association, Pádraic Ó Cuaib. And one of the, initially it was set up to bring in films from international productions that could educate people, mostly, you know, around Catholic theology and the like, and the missions, for example, spreading the word in the developing world, as we now call it. But very quickly, they began to make their own productions. And within 3 years of being set up, they began to make films, highlights, packages of the All-Ireland finals in Gaelic football and in hurling from 1948 on. And these were very, very popular films in this period. As one could imagine, they were much longer and more detailed and more insightful in terms of being produced by people who actually understood Gaelic games and could provide that kind of informed commentary on the games. So from 1948 on, up until the emergence, and indeed after the emergence of television, so Irish Indigenous television started filming Gaelic games from 1962 onwards, but particularly up to that period, these films, short 10-minute productions, highlights of the All-Ireland finals in both hurling and Gaelic football, were produced every year and circulated around the country. And these were some of the most popular early examples of what was a growing Indigenous Irish film culture. And the film, that Indigenous culture in this period through the 40s, 50s, 60s was primarily about filming what we'd call kind of rudimentary documentary, or rather than fiction, it was filming aspects of social reality, here sport or other aspects of life in Ireland in that period. And there was quite a few natural history films, for example, also produced, films about Indigenous traditional music and so on. And sport was one of the most popular examples, and it gave various filmmakers who would go on to success in other spheres the opportunity to learn their trade and to build up a kind of experience and expertise in film practice. They drew large audiences across Ireland to cinemas, and they're a key record for us now of the development of Gaelic games between the 40s right up until the end of the 1960s, when they were being produced less often because television had basically filled that space and was now producing them. Gaelin, you mentioned there, so in the same period, well, in the 1950s, another organization that emerged that was very important was Gaelin, or Gaelin, an Irish language organization that's dedicated to the promotion and preservation of the Irish language. And they realized very quickly that film was an important tool. It was set up in 1953, and from then on, they started to produce from 1956 to 1963 an Indigenous newsreel called Aviarc Éireann, or A View on Ireland in English, that was included sport quite prominently. And but what the advantage of the Gaelin, the National Film Institute, films focused on just the final stage of the All-Ireland series, the finals, whereas the Gaelin shot short items of earlier stages in that competition and in the other major competition, the National League, across Ireland. And these films are fascinating in terms of giving us a moving image kind of record of other parts of Ireland in this period through the 1950s and into the 1960s. And they also produced two longer films that I talk about in some length in the book. One about football, Gaelic football, called Pell in 1962, and one about hurling called Christy Ring from 1964. And Christy Ring, for people unfamiliar with hurling, is arguably the greatest exponent of the sport of hurling ever. He's has a godlike status in Ireland for followers of Gaelic games even today. It's hard to think of an equivalent in any, perhaps Messi in association football today, or Ronaldo, or someone of that status. So this is an extraordinarily important film in terms of him sharing the skills of hurling in that period, and having a record of that. But these two institutions, these two organizations, and the films they produced were a critical part of an emerging indigenous film culture, in which Gaelic games was one of the most popular subjects that was featured in this indigenous film culture that was emerging in this period.
And really, for me, what stuck out for me was a critical way of reforging at home and potentially even internationally this idea of what Irishness was. Instead of, you know, violent sports, these were sophisticated, gay, you know. So could you talk a little bit about, set that up a little bit? I think it's crucial, of course, because your latter two chapters kind of introduced more critical views on that as well.
Yes. No, absolutely. Like, you're absolutely right. So, that was, for both organizations, for both the National Film Institute of Ireland and for Gaelin, they were key components of a popular movement in the aftermath of World War II to redefine and to celebrate Irishness, what it is to be Irish, and in a period that Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, was neutral during World War II. So that was a kind of a challenging statement and process in terms of a context where the UK was, of course, very, very much in World War II, and the US on both sides, and a lot of international pressure. So out of that, there was this increasing sense of the importance of our own kind of, in Ireland, of a distinctive culture and a distinctive polity. And within that, both the National Film Institute and Gaelin were using sport as a means of celebrating and indeed of defining what it is to be Irish, and that these sports were critical in that process. They were of Ireland, they were popular, they were distinctive. And they also, I touch upon this briefly, but there is a gender issue here, of course, that we need to acknowledge, that the Gaelic Lad Association has only men and boys, so to speak. It doesn't have female members. There is another association that plays Gaelic games called the Ladies Gaelic Football Association. And there's also another sport called Camogie, which is the female version of hurling. And there's a lot to cover here. I'm not going to get into this in great detail, but just to say that the Gaelic Lad Association has always been about Irish masculinity. And in this period, there was also that focus that sport wasn't just something that was distinctly Irish and provided a means of celebrating and affirming that distinctiveness, but also about the mask, you know, celebrating physicality and masculinity, and that these are also components within what is going on in this period in the 1950s, 1960s, in the aftermath of World War II, and in a period when, particularly the 50s was, again, an extraordinarily challenging period in Ireland, a period of a very high unemployment, high immigration, and that sport was one of the few kind of positive forces within our popular cultural forces that really grew and blossomed in terms of, for example, the attendance at sports, which by the end of the early 1960s, you had over 90,000 people attending All-Ireland finals in Dublin, growing hugely in that period, and that growth would be sustained through the 1960s and into the 70s.
So it is in that period of the 60s and 70s, though, and here we come to your final two chapters before your conclusion. It's starting, really, you point out in the year 1968, such a momentous year in European history, a more critical view on Gaelic games. So I'm wondering if, you know, you can walk us through maybe a couple, maybe one iteration from that early 60s to 80s period, and then maybe one film from the more contemporary period that presents a more complicated view of Irishness and through the lens of one of the Gaelic games.
Yeah, so the film that I talk about that's kind of a key text on a number of levels, but including from the Gaelic games, is Rocky Road, Rocky Road to Dublin, directed by Peter Lennon in 1967, released 68, a film that was not just important in terms of how it casts a critical eye on Gaelic games in Ireland, but more generally how it was one of the first texts, film texts, to critically engage with Irish society and culture, but not from the point of view of the stereotype. But here it's about asking searching questions about whether the society had really moved on post-independence, whether the church had too much power in Ireland, whether poverty and emigration and various other kind of social issues were being adequately addressed by governments. And within that, Peter Lennon focuses in one section on the Gaelic Lad Association and Gaelic Games. And he kind of interrogates, in particular, he's asking questions about the ways in which the kind of more narrow-minded conception of Irishness that still continued to be promoted by that association in that period. Evident, for example, in at that time and right into the early up until 1973, the Gaelic Athletic Association forbid members or people playing or attending their sports from engaging with or attending any inverted commas scarecrows foreign sports. By that they referred not to, by the way, baseball or American football, but specifically to cricket, soccer and rugby, English sports, which were viewed as viewed very negatively in that period by the people running Gaelic games. And this is one of the points that Lennon takes up, that we needed a more open, more progressive sense of Irishness, and that the way in which the Gaelic Athletic Association was maintaining this ban was problematic in that context and needed to be moved beyond. And so that's part of that documentary film he produced. It looks at that and asks questions about whether this, about the need for Ireland as a whole and Gaelic Athletic Association in this context as well, to move on, to embrace a more open, a more progressive, a more pluralistic sense of Irishness in that period. And those sentiments would feed into what we might call a critically engaged indigenous film culture that began to emerge into the 1970s with a range of filmmakers like, for example, Bob Quinn, Joe Comerford, Pat Murphy, who would continue that interrogation of Irish society and culture. One of the films I talk about from the 1980s in the book is a film, Clash of the Ash, by Fergus Tighe, which is very much, again, casting a critical eye on Irish society in the 1980s, another decade of very high unemployment, high immigration, of political malaise, and again, raising questions about the failure of the state to really respond proactively and progressively to these challenges, one of which is the continuing very powerful and repressive role of the Catholic Church in Ireland in that period. And he uses sport, he looks at, uses hurling as the kind of frame for that, the star player of the local hurling club, as a part of that investigation and of that critique. And it's one of the best kind of fiction depictions of hurling, still stands today in that respect. In its insight into Irish society, into the kind of important role that sport has in Irish culture, but also as a kind of a critically engaged text exploring the, I suppose, like Lennon, he's raising questions about whether part of the reason why Ireland was not engaging more effectively with various social challenges was that it was being held back by a kind of a nostalgic narrow nationalist kind of view of itself and of Irish society, whereas it needed to be much more progressive and open and pluralist to international influence, both cultural and political, and to move forward in those areas.
And your final chapter, I think, for me, was one of the most interesting. It in some ways looks at how people looked at Gaelic games as a way to re-evaluate Irish history, independence, in particular. I don't know if you want to talk really briefly about Michael Collins in Gaelic games, or Ken Loach's Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is a film I loved, in Gaelic games. But I'd love it if you could talk about that really quickly as well.
Yeah, no problem. The final chapter, which my the copy editor said was one of the best titles he'd ever come across in chapter. I'm gonna.
Yeah,
I just had to mention that because
I could give it if you want.
Yeah. So the Hurley is the new chainsaw, Gaelic games and contemporary cinema. I just explained that as a way into to this to your question, and that is that there. One of the things I talk about in this chapter is the way in which in the contemporary context you have really a variety of forces informed by those historical precedences and contemporary kind of challenges that are coming together to produce more curious in some ways depictions of Gaelic games, but also in other ways more innovative depictions, and how Gaelic games can function within an increasing transnational world we live in today. And one of the ways in which that's evident is how it combines with, say, genre and popular genres. So I talk in that chapter about how Parling features within this one horror film called Dead Meat, and how it becomes a force to kind of a part of an attempt by an indigenous or of a local culture to protect itself from marauding zombies, right? And that the stereotype, in a way, the stereotype of the violent violence associated with hurling is transformed into something that becomes about defending a local community, but also kind of poking fun at the stereotypes that we've already talked about. In terms of the two films you mentioned, Michael Collins and The Wind That Shakes the Barley, so I kind of look at these and kind of in contrasting ways, insofar as that Michael Collins was a film directed by Neil Jordan, but produced and funded by Warner Bros. Again, but a relatively mid-budget film, but a film that was very much about producing this epic Hollywood story based around this huge figure in the War of Independence and in that kind of tumultuous period at the end of the 1910s in Ireland, Michael Collins, the leader of the military leader, I suppose you might say, of the Irish movement towards independence. And within that, it features one of the most, I suppose, disturbing episodes in that War of Independence in 1920, when members of the British Army stormed Croke Park in Dublin during a game between Tipperary, a Gaelic football game between Tipperary and Dublin, and opened fire on players and on supporters. And that's reenacted within Michael Collins. What I touch upon in the film, I mean, it's extraordinary. Tragic moment in Irish history and in Irish sporting history. But in the film, it becomes an opportunity to kind of contribute to the overall kind of epic drama of the film. So what was, it was obviously a tragic event in what happened, a horrific event, but it's transformed from an event where soldiers climbed over a wall with rifles and fired on spectators and players to an event where an armoured car with machine guns in the film, as it's depicted, busts through the gates, goes onto the centre of the pitch, and then opens fire with a machine gun on the players. It becomes this, Jordan adds this additional kind of drama that didn't actually happen on the day itself, which is responding again, I guess, to the expectations of Hollywood high-octane drama action that the his sense that it needed that additional kind of element to respond to what audiences might want to see in a film, which doesn't correlate to what actually happened in the period. The Windischicks Barley is quite different insofar as it's an independent production. I mean, I think it had about five producers internationally, French, Spanish, co-funders, British, Irish, directed by the English independent director Ken Loach. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with Ken Loach's work, one of the most important independent directors in world cinema today. And it has a beautiful opening sequence that is a 3.5 minute sequence of a hurling game. And he uses hurling very deliberately in that sequence to define the distinctiveness, this distinctive culture in Ireland and in this part of Ireland, which is West Cork in the southwest of Ireland, in the colonial context, in the context of the Irish War of Independence against the British rule and British control in Ireland. And I look at those two pieces together and talk about, even in terms of their length of time on screen, the reenactment of Bloody Sunday in Michael Collins is in total, I think, about 20 seconds, where you have, you know, 3.5 minutes in Loach's film, that he allows for this sequence to reveal itself and to slowly kind of take place, to happen, to move, and to open up a way into a distinctive culture that you don't get in Jordan's film, because I think Jordan's film, again, is driven by a kind of a Hollywood sensibility and a Hollywood exigencies about action and movement. And you couldn't possibly have a lengthy 3.5 minute sequence that's focusing on a sport that most of the viewers would never have seen or be aware of. Whereas Loach is willing to allow for that to happen, and that can become a defining moment, which it is. It's the opening sequence of the entire film, and it's the sequence that defines this sport and this culture for audiences familiar and unfamiliar with Ireland.
Well, I mean, this was, I would say, my favorite chapter. I want to emphasize for listeners that we've just touched on many of the things that Sean covers in his work. And from my point of view, leading the questions, a very kind of historical look at some of these questions, but that Sean also takes on film as technology, film as representation, spends a lot of time talking about narrative and reportage. So this is not exhaustive in any way. I want to finish with one quick question, which is the traditional last question, which is, now that we've enjoyed this book, what can we look forward to you next, Sean? What are you working on now?
So right now, I've a number of different, much as I wear a number of different hats in NUI Galway, I'm also working on a number of different projects at the moment. I suppose there's kind of two areas that I'm looking. One, in terms of the focus on sport and film, I'm now looking at expanding from the Irish to looking at the kind of European context more broadly. And I've already done some, I gave a keynote at a conference earlier this year where I did a quantitative survey of European sports cinema. It's not something that a lot of work has been done on. The American context has been very well researched and covered, but the European context less so. So I'm now looking at writing, ultimately working towards a monograph, looking at the distinctiveness of the European experience of sports cinema. Parallel to that, I'm also looking at developing a project here in NUI Galway, which is combining, I guess, practice and theory, and looking at how film can be employed, or I suppose not just film, but more broadly, digital media can be employed as a tool to encourage and facilitate physical activity and sport. So how we can use digital media tools in that context. I'm working with people here working in the health sciences and health and well-being exploring ways in which, using what we call a participative videography approach, we can use film proactively and progressively to encourage people to reflect on their physical activity and their understanding of sport, and to kind of communicate that back as part of larger research question and project.
Both of those projects sound fascinating. For me, particularly the first one, I'm going to have to keep an eye out for that and be interested to see it when it finally comes out. Thank you very much for joining us today, Sean. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to the New Books in Sports on the a channel on the New Books Network. We've been here with Sean Crossan, who is the author of Gaelic Games on Film, From Silent Films to Hollywood Hurling Horror, and The Emergence of Irish Cinema, out from Cork University Press. Thank you again very much for joining us, Sean. Thank you, everyone, for
listening. My pleasure.
And have a great day.